At Farm Credit Mid-America, we do more than lend. We lift up our rural communities that we serve, too. From our day-to-day business of supporting farmers to our community investment efforts and scholarships for students, we help local rural communities find their next level. Visit fcma.com/community to learn more about our commitment to communities. Farm Credit Mid-America is an equal opportunity lender.
Welcome in. We're in Denver for Commodity Classic here on the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast. It's brought to you by the Indiana Corn Growers Association, the Indiana Soybean Alliance, with support from Indiana Farm Bureau. And we are here talking policy at Commodity Classic. Plenty of policy taking place. And probably the hottest topic here, as you can imagine, trade. It's being talked about all over the trade show floor, and not, you know, in that trade show. It is the trade that is happening between countries. Obviously, a lot of talk right now, Mexico, Canada, China, and the tariffs. And we brought the perfect people in to talk about it. Steve Howell is here with me, as usual. Steve, hello.
Hey,
welcome.
Good to see you, Eric.
We catch up in other states as well. I can't shake you. This is just the way that it goes.
Yeah, it's like a bad penny. Just keeps showing up. But it's great to be here out at Commodity Classic. As you said, there's a lot of policy work being done. We'll focus today on trade issues. Both organizations, the Indiana Soybean Alliance membership and the Policy Committee, as well as the Corn Growers Association, have their delegate sessions at Commodity Classic with ASA and NCGA, and our farmers have participated in that. A lot of discussion around trade and other issues, and it's good to be out here.
Several Indiana farmers out here doing just that.
So yes.
It's a great contingent of Indiana farmers out here coming to Denver. And we also have Nancy Martinez here with the National Corn Growers Association, a returning guest on the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast.
Yes, I am.
So very happy to have you back, Nancy. The last time we spoke, we were talking about biotech corn and the issues with Mexico. So we're happy to get an update here in just a little bit on that. So that's good news. And Virginia Houston is here from the American Soybean Association. Virginia.
Thank you so much for having me, Eric. Letting a Tennessean crash the Hoosier podcast.
Well, that's okay. We'll forgive you. It's all right. We're welcoming. It's that Hoosier hospitality.
I love it. Thank you.
So, trade. It is the hot topic. And honestly, by the time this gets out, some things could change because it's ever-changing in what I'll call this Trump world. It's just rapidly evolving. Let's begin with where we are. Let's get this update because I'm curious to see just where we're at. The biotech corn issue that we discussed last time, before we get to all the things that can change, this is something that might be a little bit more constant, Nancy. We got the biotech corn thing kind of sort of mostly figured out. Let's go back and let's talk about that, because that was a big issue that, you know, we were going through the USMCA, the dispute panel. I was trying to figure out how I could get on that dispute, be a judge. We were going through the whole thing, how I could get that gig. But we figured it out, right?
Yeah, we're in a really good position. So just backing up a little bit, Mexico is the top market for corn exports. About half of our corn goes to Mexico, so it's a crucial market for us. When Mexico took action to ban GM corn, that was obviously very concerning because over 94% of the corn that we grow in the United States is genetically modified. So, you know, we were able to fight Mexico's actions through the dispute panel, and that culminated into a final panel report, which was dropped in December 20th, I believe. And that report overwhelmingly showed that Mexico violated our trade agreement, USMCA. They took actions that were not based on science, and it wholeheartedly sided with the U.S. position. So we had a really clear and convincing win with that report. So now it becomes to how Mexico is going to comply with that report. So they took some really great first steps to rescind parts of their decree that banned GM corn. So we were very encouraged by that. They do have a constitutional amendment that is making its way through their legislature. That amendment bans cultivation of GM corn, but there is a provision that we're watching carefully, and that provision requires more evaluation for GM corn uses. So obviously that's a little confusing for market clarity, so we're trying to work with the Mexican government to make sure that they know our concerns, and that amendment will proceed to their Senate this week sometime.
And you're right, that was a huge win for corn here in the U.S., but this was something that other organizations were watching as well, right? Like soybean, you guys weren't just necessarily sitting on the sideline. Like this was a major win for agriculture, right, Virginia?
Of course, because, you know, first and foremost, no farmer just grows corn or just grows soybeans. Our farmers grow both, and so a win for U.S. corn is also a win for U.S. soy. It's a win for U.S. agriculture because the actions that Mexico took were not science-based, they were not following their trade commitments, and that would set a very dangerous precedent for all U.S. ag exports. So we weren't on the front lines the way corn growers are, but we were also weighing in behind the scenes, letting the government know that ASA was there supporting them, finding a solution that maintained market access into Mexico for U.S. ag.
Yeah, because, again, if we go away from science-based, like that's bad news for everybody.
Right, and we were also concerned that other countries could use the same playbook because obviously countries are trying to use, you know, their own protectionist ways to limit trade. So we definitely didn't want them to get any ideas from Mexico's efforts.
And Steve, this kind of work, kind of coming back to the Indiana Corn Growers Association, the Indiana Soybean Alliance, this kind of work that got done at the national level, This goes back to the membership of your organizations, right? This is kind of what feeds upward.
Yeah, it absolutely does. And actually going back to when we realized that we had a problem with Mexico and the biotech issue, it was the ag organizations, primarily national corn growers, and through the voice of the farmer, was able to advocate to the administration that they had to take action. And that frankly, the action wouldn't have happened had it not been for the farmer's voice making sure that the administration took action. And because of the action, we see a success. So, you know, your membership is paying off. And so as a member of the Indiana Corn Growers Association and the Indiana Soybean Alliance, you also get the representation of ASA and NCGA here in Washington, D.C. So you, not only are you a member of the state organizations, you become a member of the national groups as well. And we need that. We need these folks, Virginia and Nancy, you know, really leading the efforts on trade. We have other staff that maybe they work on regulatory issues, biofuel issues. We need that. Those boots on the ground in Washington, D.C., with the farmer's voice, working for farmers every day, and these two organizations do that very well for us.
I mean, you guys go and you meet with the Indiana delegation regularly, but there are other folks in D.C. that work on things, not just, you know, Senator Young, Senator Banks, and the rest of the congressmen, even though we do have two on the House Ag Committee now. There are other folks in D.C. other than just the Indiana folks.
Yeah, we really do focus on our Indiana delegation, and they need to hear from us. They want to hear from us. They want to know what's happening in their districts, and we can provide that for them. But there's 535 members of Congress, both the Senate and the House, numerous federal agencies that we have to communicate with, have to get our voice heard, and that's where ASA and NCGA do that for us.
All right, let's get down to it. Trade, we've put this off long enough. You know, I talk about the three T's, Trump, trade, tariffs. In having conversations with Ted McKinney, I'm like, you know, you're one of the only guys that can really, you know, get down to the three T's better than anyone else, because he dealt with it in the first Trump administration. But it seems like from Trump 1 to Trump 2 now, this is a far different ball game. And primarily because we have Mexico and Canada involved at a much larger scale now. You know, obviously, in Trump 1, we were going through USMCA, but that seemed like a bit more of a, you know, negotiation maybe. But But now it's like we have USMCA in place, but we're trying to renegotiate what we already negotiated. Is that kind of what it seems like? Are we renegotiating this thing a little too early? Where are we going on this thing?
Yeah, so USMCA is already up for review in 2026. So it does look like there's a renewed effort to speed up the process and take a look at the whole agreement in its entirety. USMCA was great for agriculture in the sense that it helped to get those supply chains moving quicker. We can export in a more integrated way. So it's very beneficial on that front. Now I know there's other longstanding issues with the agreement for other industries. So I think those will have to work itself out as we get further along. But the agreement was really great at increasing export opportunities for American corn growers specifically.
And from the soy perspective, NAFTA, now USMCA, is really just the pinnacle of a success story as far as what a free trade agreement can do for U.S. agriculture. So under NAFTA, soy exports to Mexico quadrupled. So Mexico is now the number two market for the whole soy complex. So that's beans, meal, and oil. In Canada, exports have doubled, and now Canada is a top three market for U.S. soybean meal. And that market's even more important now as we're seeing crush capacity for biofuels come online in Dakotas. We need somewhere for that meal to go, and Canada is the most natural partner to take that meal from us. But the threat of tariffs hanging over our head does put a damper on our enthusiasm because we're not sure what will happen to that market.
Well, that was my next question, is what does happen to it if as we sit here and talk on Monday, if Tuesday comes and tariffs do go on Mexico and Canada, what does happen? Or say it's not even tomorrow, say, and who knows what happens, but say President Trump comes out and he says, you know what, they've done enough here, let's push it back another month. And then a month from now it happens. Who knows? What does happen? What are the potential risks of this happening?
I think the risks are twofold. So first of all, we do rely on imports from Canada. U.S. farmers overwhelmingly rely on potash as a fertilizer input. We import 87% of that from Canada. The other major potash suppliers are Russia and Belarus, and due to their actions in the war in Ukraine, those exports have been basically cut off for U.S. farmers. So we're increasingly reliant upon those imports from Canada. But also, I think we would see a lot of market volatility. Markets don't enjoy this uncertainty. They like to know what's happening. And I think, should we see those markets be cut off for our ag exports, we're going to see prices decrease. Opportunities will dry up for our farmers. And it will just feed into overall uncertainty for markets, both domestic and export markets.
We've already seen those markets decrease quite a bit here in just the past couple weeks for both corn and beans.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And while we can't predict the future fully, we don't know exactly at what levels some of the tariffs will be in place. Both of our organizations did release a study last year to show the effects of what a trade war would look like on agriculture if it would happen today. And there was a few, obviously concerning things with prices dropping further, lost market opportunities, obviously. And then, South American countries, really benefit from this. Countries like Brazil and Argentina, who are already coming online to be bigger and better in the agriculture space, they're ready to take market share if we are limited in our export opportunities. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned South America, and it seems like in many cases they are getting bigger and better, and it's already taking market share even before all of these things are happening. What does it look like from a competitive standpoint? I mean, obviously these tariffs aren't helping. What do we need to do to be more competitive in that space, outside of even get rid of these tariffs thing? Like, what do we need to do from a trade standpoint to be more competitive in that space?
Well, I think first of all, U.S. soybean farmers, and I know U.S. corn farmers as well, have a great story to tell as far as the sustainability of our product. Our farmers are true conservationists. They have been growing their products for generations using soil conservation methods, looking at ways to reduce tillage, improve cover crops, decrease runoff and nutrient management. And we know that our product is growing in a very sustainable manner. I think on the international stage, we're still seeing that message be very important, especially for our partners in Europe. That's also a large market for soybean exports, and they really value that sustainability story. So I think that will become even more important moving forward to sort of try to value differentiate ourselves when there are tariffs. But yes, there are tariffs, but also remember, we have a very high quality product that you still want to have at the end of the day. So, you know, leaning more on that will hopefully be one outlet to remain competitive. But, you know, Nancy touched on Brazil. Just they have 200,000 hectares of pasture land they can convert to bean and corn production tomorrow if they so chose. And we just don't have that much land available to compete. So we have to look for ways to differentiate ourselves above what they are offering on the global marketplace.
Yeah, and Virginia mentioned sustainability and our high-quality products. I mean, American corn has a higher starch content than what's grown in South America, so we feel like we have an edge on that for sure. But you were talking about how we can kind of combat and what do we need in exchange, and it's market access. You know, we need an aggressive approach to getting deals and supply chains set with some of these countries who are really salivating to work with the United States. You know, we've identified different areas of the world as priority areas for the corn industry, and we're really hopeful to get some traction there. You know, the administration, you know, kind of with these tariff announcements, have asked for comments from the public, and we are actively working on submitting a full and complete list of all these different options for the administration to look at some trade deals.
Yeah, I guess one of the other things that we can do, and we actually just recently had a meeting with Congressman Mark Mesmer, our new congressman from Southwest Indiana District 8. He serves on the Ag Committee, and we had a conversation with him about the concerns on tariffs, and he said, well, there may be options for exemptions. So, because we had a pretty good conversation about the concern about potash, and he said, give me those details, and he can run it up through Chairman G.T. Thompson, perhaps really advocate for an exemption on some of this. So, you know, more work needs to be done, but, you know, we'll have the comment periods. Now, that's not related to trade deals, but kind of on the tariff issue. There's ways that we will continue to carry the farmer's voice on this and hopefully soften the blow.
Yeah. You know, you talk about being aggressive on trade deals. You can look at the difference between the two administrations, the Biden administration and the Trump administration. I think it's fair to say that if you look at the Biden administration, trade was not necessarily a focus. You look at the Trump administration, trade is certainly a focus. I think you say he's being aggressive, maybe not in the way that everyone would love, but he's certainly being aggressive on trade. Is there somewhere in between? Yeah, there probably is. I'm not going to ask you two to go and comment on that. But there is certainly the difference between the two administrations. It is just a matter of again, finding that right balance and finding the right places. You mentioned the market access and where we can find. Where are those places? Where are the places of opportunity for U.S. corn, for U.S. soybeans that have been identified that we really need to get after?
Absolutely. So I do want to go back briefly to your comparison of the administrations, because we did have a missed opportunity on market access in the Biden administration. And I just want to highlight that because, you know, through the Biden administration's work in the Indo-Pacific, which is a critical region of the world for us to be engaged, we didn't have market access provisions in that trade work. So I think when we revisit that region of the world, we need to be aggressive in figuring out which countries are willing to work with the United States. I think Vietnam is an excellent opportunity to go after for on the corn side, soybean side as well. You know, Thailand has always been one of those friendly partners on the trade side. So those are definitely some really concrete options. There's also opportunities in the African continent with Kenya. The Kenyan courts just recently upheld a decision to allow GM exports to come into the country, which is a huge foothold in Africa. And if we can help use that decision to hopefully export corn and other items, other countries will see the benefit there. And I do want to mention, you know, Europe, obviously a lot of challenges there, but the UK has been really willing to work on trade issues with the United States. They've actually set up memorandums with other states around in the United States apart from us as a country. So they are really looking to set up some, you know, good pathways to get goods moving.
Because podcasting is a visual medium, I know your listeners can't see me sitting here nodding to everything Nancy just said. I think Nancy hit the nail on the head, really, with Vietnam, with the African continent, with Kenya, as also as opportunities for U.S. soy. You know, there has been chatter recently about the signed MOU between the U.S. and India and how that could offer trade opportunities. That's a very ambitious market, but one that we would love to tap. You know, India is also very protectionist. They impose tariffs on soybean imports of upwards of 50%. And they also are fairly anti-GMO. They don't really have an approval process for imports of GM crops. So we face both high tariff and non-tariff barriers in that market. That does not mean we're not working on that market, but it's much more of a heavier lift and a longer-term issue than a issue or a market we think could be open in the short term.
And I will just agree with what Virginia said on India. India is a great opportunity for some low-hanging fruit, especially with DDGs. That's a country that can, you know, really benefit from taking our DDG exports. And ethanol, we know that they're trying to boost their ethanol use, and we can definitely help with those needs.
You guys agree an awful lot, don't you?
We do.
Is there a lot of collaboration, a lot of work between the two of you and the two organizations that... I mean, you mentioned most corn guys, they grow soybeans too. They grow corn. You guys work pretty well together.
I sometimes joke that Nancy and I could not work closer together if we weren't attached to the hip. We do collaborate very frequently. We are talking almost on a daily basis about every issue that we're facing. So in the trade space, ASA and NTGA are hand-in-hand, step-in-step together.
It benefits both organizations for us to work so closely together, and it just elevates the amount of attention we get on different issues.
Yeah. You had mentioned the tariffs that, you know, India puts on. I think it's interesting, you know, we've talked about the tariffs that we're talking about putting on Mexico and Canada and China even, and everything else. I saw something recently that really, the U.S., we put fewer tariffs on other countries than most. One, is that true? And two, when we actually take a step back and look at it, are we maybe overreacting a bit? Maybe overreacting isn't the right word, but when we talk about these tariffs, is there a different way to look at it?
I mean, we're always going to be a proponent of trying to get our exports into more places and focus on the market access side of it. I mean, we've heard from the president that he's focused on these trade imbalances and wants to kind of right the ship in some regard. And we're here to say, look, we have all these opportunities with our ag exports. Please focus on that. You know, obviously, we understand where he's coming from, you know, but our concern is with the impact on farmers. You know, we already have a tough economic environment, low prices, very high cost of inputs. If we don't have a place to put our exports around the globe, it's really going to be hard for us to weather some of these tariff uncertainties.
And we've heard a lot of talk about the growing ag trade deficit. And, you know, I think we all agree that is a problem. But I was listening to a very fascinating presentation by Dr. Andrew Muhammad at the University of Tennessee. And, you know, he had a really great point that the WTO classifies alcohol as an agricultural product. And what does the U.S. import a lot of? Tequila. European liquors, European wine. And that can really skew the numbers when it looks like, because unfortunately, you know, soybeans and corn aren't considered the most high value of products, but imported alcohol is a very high value product. So that can definitely, if you're just looking at the numbers, it looks very skewed, but when in actuality, we're still exporting a lot, but we are importing very high value products that just simply tip the scales in favor of imports because of the value of the product.
That makes sense. Let's take a time out here on the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast. When we come back, we are going to talk China. We've managed to avoid China in this whole conversation. Virginia thought I forgot about it. She Again, this isn't a visual medium.
I was crossing my fingers.
Yeah, she thought I forgot all about China, but we're going to come back and we're going to talk about that. We're going to say bye to Steve now. He's got other places to run.
I do. I've got a meeting to get to, just more work here out at the Commodity Classic. So thanks, Eric, for taking some time to visit with us.
Absolutely. We appreciate the sponsorship from the Indiana Corn Growers Association, the Indiana Soybean Alliance, and I hope you guys have a good time out here in Denver.
So we will.
We'll be back right after this on the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast.
There is strength in numbers. That's why the Indiana Soybean Alliance membership and policy and Indiana Corn Growers Association need you. These organizations represent Indiana soybean and corn farmers on critical and regulatory issues affecting their industry. Along with support from the national organizations, National Corn Growers Association and American Soybean Association, the Indiana members help determine public policy positions on critical issues, including farm bills, trade policy, and ethanol and biodiesel legislation. Become a member of Indiana Soybean Alliance membership, Indiana Corn Growers Association, or both. Visit incornandsoy.org to select a membership. That's incornandsoy.org.
At Indiana Farm Bureau, we serve tree farmers, goat farmers, and in fact, all farmers. With over 250,000 members, Indiana Farm Bureau represents a broad range of farmers and puts power in your collective voice. You also get advice from our subject matter experts, more affordable health plan options, and support for youth programs statewide. So whether you grow soybeans or strawberries, membership means you'll be heard. Become a member today at infb.org.
We're back on the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast. It's presented by the Indiana Corn Growers Association, the Indiana Soybean Alliance, with support from Indiana Farm Bureau. We're in Denver for Commodity Classic. I'm with Virginia Houston with the American Soybean Association, Nancy Martinez from the National Corn Growers Association, and we are talking trade. And we spent first half of the program talking Mexico and Canada, and Virginia thought I forgot about China. She was hoping, praying. I didn't. Let's talk China. Seeing reports already today, again, as we speak on Monday, the 3rd, that they're already lining up their retaliatory tariffs and that ag is the number one target, as anticipated. This is no secret. Agriculture was the top target during Trump 1 when all of this was happening the first time around. During Trump 1, after all of this happened, we did end up with the Phase 1 trade deal. So I guess there's that we could look forward to, I guess. But we're still living in this moment right now, and this is where we're at. So your thoughts, Virginia, on China that I didn't forget about.
You did not forget about it, Eric. You know, I could filibuster for 45 minutes with a seminar on China, but, you know, we're seeing right now that past is prologue. So in 2018, President Trump, under his first administration, imposed Section 301 tariffs on imports from China, and China swiftly retaliated. And they hit ag products first, so almost immediately, soybeans to China from the U.S. were slapped with a 25% tariff. So that effectively overnight shut us out of the market. I do remember there was a big push on Chinese social media and the news about the last container ship trying to get to China before the tariffs went into place. Unfortunately, it missed the date by 5 hours. So those soybeans on that container ship were subject to tariffs, and it was the little cargo ship that could. That was in 2018. You mentioned the Phase 1 agreement. That was signed in 2020. So our farmers had to endure 2 years of depressed markets, basically being locked out of the Chinese market, facing depressed prices, because when those tariffs went in place, our farmers saw the price for soybeans drop by about $2 a bushel, not to mention being locked out of our biggest market. For some context, China does dominate the global oilseed market. Their demand for soybeans cannot be matched by any other country in the world. They maintain the world's largest swine herd, largest poultry flock, and they are the biggest aquaculture producer in the world. And all of those hungry animals really rely on high quality soybeans for feed. And so that's what makes up the bulk of their demand. So not to mention in 2018, the tariffs went into place at the same time that China was facing an outbreak of African swine fever. So demand diminished, prices went down, and our farmers suffered. again, 2020, phase one agreement was signed. We regained market access in China. Prices have went back up over time. But our reputation was damaged, and we're still dealing with the ramifications of that today, and not just in China. Our trading partners no longer see U.S. soy as the most reliable provider of soybeans on the global market because of the uncertainty from the administration about what's going to happen with tariffs. Now, if you fast forward to today, March 3rd, which this could all change by tomorrow, there is already a 10% tariff on China put in place by President Trump earlier in February. He's preparing an additional 10% on top of that to bring that to a 20% tariff. And we are also hearing China has their list of retaliatory tariffs ready. We anticipate U.S. soy is probably on that list. And we're bracing for impact. I wish I had happier news to share, but unfortunately, I think most days in tariffs, it's not usually a good story to tell.
I'm guessing that it's not just on that list. It may very well be at the very top.
I don't want to speculate, but I think you may be right.
Yeah. You're right. During that period, in speaking with a market analyst just a little while ago, you know, the two-thirds of the China hog herd was gone during that time. I mean, there were a number of factors, but it still hurt. It still hurt big.
Absolutely.
And during this time now, I guess, you know, one thing that he wanted folks to understand is, yeah, the media, and he pointed at me, you know, hey, the media might want to blame, you know, what's going on with the administration and everything, but really right now, Brazil is going to be the cheaper source of soybeans for the next 6 to 9 months anyway.
Yes.
So we need to keep that in mind also, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we should just be shut out of China for the next 6 to 9 months completely.
No.
Because of these tariffs.
And China's an opportunistic buyer. They will buy when the price is right, when they have needs, and when they so choose. But one thing I tend to remind policymakers and others who are asking me questions about, well, what does this mean for agriculture, is that in 2018, the ag economy was in a stronger position than it is in 2025. Farmer margins were higher, prices were higher at the time, and farmers were able to make it through for a couple of rough years. We're in the rough years right now, and if you look back, USDA's Economic Research Service put a study forward that showed the economic damage done to U.S. ag, and the 2018 trade war resulted in losses of $27 billion for U.S. agriculture, and of that $27 billion, soybeans accounted for 71% of those losses. Our farmers are going to have a harder time weathering a prolonged trade conflict with our biggest trading partner right now than they did in the first Trump administration.
Yeah. What about for corn growers? Again, many of the same.
Right.
Corn and soybean growers are the same folks. But from the corn standpoint, what does this look like?
So China used to be one of our top markets. You know, we exported a record 21 million metric tons of corn to China in 2021, but they have really fallen off the map as one of our top buyers of corn. You know, now they're not even in the top five. And so, you know, we have a missed market opportunity there, but we also have these biotech challenges that are becoming increasingly troublesome for the corn industry. You know, China is doing everything that they can to diversify against the United States, just like we're trying to diversify, you know, out of China. But what they're doing on biotech approvals, you know, is something that we have an eye on. It's a very unpredictable approval process. The China Phase One agreement included all these commitments for China to streamline the biotech approval process, so developers could have some certainty with bringing a trait to market. And China hasn't lived up to those commitments. So, I mean, our goal and our hope is that going into a potential negotiation with China, that those biotech issues are a main focus of what a deal could look like.
And you mentioned, you know, trying to diversify and diversify that market. The fact remains that, and you said it earlier, we can diversify all we want, and we do need to. We need to find other markets. We're not going to replace China. That's just not going to happen.
No, it's almost impossible. You know, we hear about market diversification all the time, and I remind them that during the first trade war, U.S. soybean farmers did an amazing job at diversifying and building new markets with resources from USDA to build up markets like Egypt, like Morocco, like Colombia, non-traditional markets. But what they import cannot rival the scale of Chinese demand. It's not diversification of markets, it's diversification of scale that's almost impossible. Because as I mentioned earlier, no other market can rival the Chinese demand. Honestly, for U.S. soy, the demand of China is bigger than the rest of our export markets around the world combined. So it's our big pot. And, you know, to lose access to that marketplace would be devastating for our farmers.
Yeah. You just can't replace it. So you talked about, you know, going into a potential negotiation here. We think that's what this is all about, right? Like, this is kind of President Trump's game. You know, I haven't read his book. Maybe I should if I want to start making deals. But from what I understand, you go out, you say something outlandish, and that's the first part of making the deal. We all think that what he's trying to do is eventually get to the negotiating table. That's the hope here, right? For all of this, whether it's China, whether it's Mexico, whether it's Canada, we are trying to get back to a negotiating table at some point so that we can remove these barriers. That's the hope, right, Nancy?
Yeah, I mean, that's why we all work on trade policy. We've kind of seen how this, you know, progresses over time. I mean, we know the president is a deal maker, and he's committed to trying to find, you know, ways to hopefully open up market access and kind of, you know, make the sausage, so to speak. You know, we just don't have all the insight and the forward knowledge of what's actually going to happen.
What's the best case scenario for agriculture as part of these deals? Is it do no harm? For example, USMCA, like you just said, it was a success story. He wants to reopen that. He wants to renegotiate it. I think it's pretty clear on that. It's do no harm, right?
Right. I mean, there's obviously risk with the renegotiation. Mm-hmm. It'll open up all of these industries to kind of get things in there that they weren't successful with first time around. So there's always that risk. But I would say, yes, it is definitely protecting the export, the current export situation that we have with our closest neighbors. So I would want to see that prioritized.
I would say maintain our current free trade agreements. Look at new free trade agreements that include tariff reducing measures and market access, but do no harm for our existing markets.
In working with the U.S. Trade Representative's office, we haven't really touched on that. We do have a new U.S. trade rep. Mm-hmm. Do you guys have relationships with the U.S. Trade Representative's office at this point, the new USTR and the Ag Representative? Like, what is the status of that right now and working through that process in trying to get more of these trade deals out there?
I would say we have excellent relationships at USTR, especially in the Ag Office with the career staff. You know, we have not yet heard a name for Chief Ag Negotiator. That's a very vital position for U.S. agriculture, but they have not put forth a nomination yet. You know, with Ambassador Greer, we're looking forward to getting in to sit down with him and talk about U.S. agriculture. He's a familiar face. He was at USTR under the previous administration. He was Lighthizer's Chief of Staff, so he is a known quantity. But that also means we know where he is on issues like China and tariffs. And so that's a little bit familiar, but also can be concerning because of what happened last time.
Yeah, like Virginia, we've got a great relationship so far. It's in the early stages, obviously, with the new folks coming in to USTR. You know, we know that Ambassador Greer knows the issues inside and out. He's very immersed in the trade world and knows how things work. So we're looking forward to getting him more up to speed on our priorities. And like I mentioned, this comment period earlier, I mean, that's a really good chance to set the stage and list out all of our major market access areas that we should go after.
As we wrap up the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast, just some final thoughts from both of you here. Nancy, I'll start with you, of what members should know, of what it is you're up to there with NCGA, working for them on the trade front. You know, Steve mentioned it earlier with their membership to the Indiana Corn Growers Association. They get membership to the National Corn Growers Association, and what you guys are up to in D.C. and around the world with trade.
Right. I mean, my job is to tell the story, the success story of how American corn is competitive and a good product, and we have so much of it that we need to find customers. So I educate the Hill, I educate the administration, I work with my ag stakeholders to make sure that that's an effective voice that's heard.
And for your Virginia final thoughts here today?
You know, I think it's just, this emphasizes the importance of engagement in your association. So thank you to all the farmers listening who are members of Indiana Soybean Alliance and Indiana Corn Growers, and through that NCGA and ASA. There's not a dull moment for Nancy and I these days. We are working daily, putting in long hours, educating Congress and the administration and our other stakeholders about our issues and how important exports are for the success of U.S. agriculture. And we will continue to fight the good fight.
Thank you for taking some time. I know this is really busy out here in Denver and at Commodity Classic. You guys have meetings like crazy and everything else. I appreciate you taking some time to do this and talk about this, quite frankly, crazy issue right now, because it is ever-changing. I'm sure you guys have been checking your, you know, Apple Watches, everything else. Be like, did they put tariffs on yet? No, not yet. Okay. It's just rapidly changing. So best of luck to both of you.
I think you're going to need it. We appreciate the well wishes. We will need this. Thank you.
We'll be in touch soon, I'm sure.
I'm sure.
So
yes.
Virginia Houston, Nancy Martinez, thank you very much. And thank you for listening to the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast from Denver and Commodity Classic. We thank our sponsors as well, the Indiana Corn Growers Association, the Indiana Soybean Alliance, and Indiana Farm Bureau.